Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Christopher Bandini with New Books and Psychoanalysis on the New Books Network. Today, we're going to speak with Robert Drozek, who wrote Psychoanalysis as an Ethical Process, which is on Routledge, and it has a foreword by Peter Fonagy. Now, Robert Drozek is an individual and group psychotherapist in the Adult Center for Borderline Personality Disorder at McLean Hospital. He serves as a teaching associate in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and as a supervisor of mentalization-based treatment through the Anna Freud Center in London. He is in private practice in Belmont, Massachusetts, specializing in the treatment of patients with borderline and narcissistic challenges. So welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much, Chris. Excited to be here.
Great. As is tradition here on New Books and Psychoanalysis, maybe you could tell us about the book and why you chose to write it, and also maybe to talk about your definition of ethics and maybe as a in contrast to how we sometimes think of it.
Okay, that sounds great. I was a philosophy major in college, and that was my main sort of area of interest and study was ethical theory, and specifically the philosophical theory of Immanuel Kant, and very interested in his notion of human dignity. So the idea of the unconditional, incomparable worth of human beings. And spent a lot of time thinking about that. And while I was in college, I was also involved in intensive psychotherapy that ultimately transitioned into a psychoanalysis, and really was taken with the correspondence between some of the ideas I was sort of immersed in and my own experience in psychoanalysis. So noticing that as I came to know myself better, learn more about myself at a greater depth, there was a shift in my experience of other people, that in areas where I would be stuck in myself, I would gain the ability to see parts of other people and to be motivated by the parts of other people, to really be more responsive to others as human beings. And I got really interested in how can we use the resources of philosophy and ethics, really, to explain how that correspondence happens. And I end up going to grad school in philosophy. That's how I moved to Boston to go to Tufts. Really kind of was like, this was going to be my life's work, focus on this. And I ended up doing an independent study and really starting to write about this stuff. And the professor, very kind sort of scholar, she you could tell she was a little taken aback by what I was writing about, and she said it's interesting and it's good, but it's not philosophy. And really that this idea that I was so interested in the processes of change in human beings, and that really philosophy was more oriented towards concepts and constructs and theories. And so I think I was taken aback by that surprise, and I ended up leaving graduate school I was like still a teaching assistant, but I just said I think I need to find what else I'm going to do. And I had a good friend who was a psychiatrist at McLean Hospital, which is where I currently work, and he he said, you know, why don't you get a job here and just work in the mental health field? And that's when really, I think, you know, I started getting exposed to the ideas of psychoanalysis. There was an analyst who was a psychiatrist on one of the units where I worked, and she really introduced me to a lot of the lexicon. I discovered the work of Stephen Mitchell, and specific, you know, relational concepts in psychoanalysis, and integration, where Mitchell was really interested in the idea that we're not just driven by self-oriented drives. We're driven by desires for connectedness and the ability to be motivated by others. And, you know, I discovered the work of Jessica Benjamin, and really Benjamin's ideas about how self-development is directly related to the ability to recognize others. And I was just blown away. Like, this is the stuff that I was sort of thinking about all the time. And there was a whole area of psychoanalysis that was really embracing these ideas. So I decided to become a clinician. And a lot of these experiences were born out in my experience of clinical work, where I would see that as my patients came to understand themselves better, know themselves better at a deeper level, you know, started to get to the reaches of their unconscious processes, that affected their responsiveness to others. And also discovered that there was a way in which I was implicated in this as well, where I am in every treatment, I would realize there was ways in which my own personality could set limits on where we could go together. And so the work of sort of becoming a psychotherapist was really, how do I be transformed by this process as well? You know, sort of Slavin and Kriegman's idea about, like, why the analyst needs to change. And so I ultimately found this very meaningful, very fulfilling, and I was able to start writing about these things, really trying to synthesize and integrate these ideas from ethics with, you know, relational psychoanalysis, really. And that's sort of the, you know, the book ultimately includes, you know, a couple of my early papers from Psychoanalytic Dialogues, but ultimately most of it's all new material, and it's really an attempt to kind of grapple with sort of integrating psychoanalysis and ethics. So specifically, to the attempt to build a psychoanalytic model that's genuinely psychoanalytic, so that really prioritizes the unconscious and transferential process, while also explaining our everyday ethical intuitions about altruism, human dignity, freedom, the importance of our behavior, and also a theory that tries to explain how it is that our responsiveness to self corresponds with our responsiveness to others. So that ultimately is what I'm trying to tackle in the book.
Just a small task.
Yeah, right. I know. It was fun, but yeah.
You didn't take on too much there.
I know. It probably does sound grand, but it's like what I've been thinking about for, you know, really for the past 20 years. So it was, you know, but yeah.
What's been the traditional place of ethics in psychoanalysis? I mean, most people, I guess my associations to, you know, the code of ethics and this type of thing. And that's not really what you're speaking about at all.
That's a great point. Yeah. And I write about this a bit in the book. I think that a lot of sort of ethical thinking and psychoanalysis has been about essentially about behavior, what I would call behavioral ethics. You know, what we should or shouldn't do with patients, what they should or shouldn't do with us. And the idea is almost as long as everybody's behaving, then ethics is not horribly relevant. Recently, there's been a burgeoning interest in issues of social justice, in the sort of the justice of institutions, and really trying to kind of apply psychoanalytic thinking to think about issues of justice and injustice. Both of those are really great, but they are kind of more external or exterior conceptions of ethics. And I think my main interest is what about ethics? Ethics having to sort of do with the center of the analytic process. You know, what happens between patient and analyst? How does change happen? So that really ethics is a not an incidental issue that may be relevant at some times and not others, but is really related to, you know, sort of everyday analytic work. And I think the only way you can get at that is if we think about ethics as involving what I call the dialectic between behavior and motivation. That if we think about ethics behaviorally, ethics is always going to be incidental to analytic process, because in psychoanalysis, we're interested in subjectivity. But if we think about ethics as what motivates us and how we're motivated by the dignity and well-being of ourselves as well as others, then suddenly ethics has a much broader relevance to the center of psychoanalysis.
And if I have it correctly, relational analysis is central to this idea, or the evolution of relational analysis is key here.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of my one of the things I'm really interested in is the trajectory of theory development in psychoanalysis, and how has it sort of evolved over time. And my sense is that concerns about ethics were driving a lot of the relational turn. That I think definitely in Greenberg and Mitchell's early text, there was sort of concerns about drives as being the primary way of explaining human experience, because there was something individualistic, at least on that early way of thinking, that there was something individualistic about drives. And then with Mitchell's work, he kind of took it, I think, to a more, he crystallized that point even more, because the concern was that somehow there was something almost demeaning about thinking about the person as being driven by endogenous drives, you know. And I think now we've kind of moved away from some of these polarities, and we could see how we could have a more inclusive way of thinking. But at the time, Mitchell was concerned about that. And if you read his writing in the 1988 book, there's a lot of this idea of the bestial core, and that there's something that doesn't feel right about the bestial core and thinking about human beings as animals. So there's a humanism in all this. And I think that was driving a lot of Mitchell's thinking, and in a lot of different ways, people have taken it up. This idea of the analyst as having too much authority or being neutral, that really there are ethical concerns there. Like, we want a more egalitarian psychoanalytic vision. So that, I think, was driven by ethics. Some of the epistemological concerns, you know, of like, I've got the truth about what's going on with the patient, that really know that we actually could be missing many things, that patients could see stuff about us that we can't see about ourselves. So I think that these concerns about ethics kind of saturated and drove a lot of these theoretical shifts that were happening in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, analytic neutrality and the idea that what neutrality looked like, which was a kind of maybe an attenuated version of the analyst or someone who was more withdrawn or held back, you know, was considered an ethical stance. Like, you were out of the way of the patient in a way. You were kind of standing out of the way so that the patient could really emerge. And then you could, and an interpretation being the key point of therapeutic action. So then you could interpret intelligently, but otherwise you were all mixed in, and that this was, I guess, you know, what we're saying in the relational turn was being questioned, this idea that someone could be neutral and that neutrality looked the way that the classical analysts thought it looked.
Well, yeah, I think that is a great point. And an interesting thing about that, and this is sort of like, I think it's important to not, I don't draw too sharp a contrast. I actually think traditional, like, ego-psychological concerns about neutrality, those were also, I think, driven by concerns about ethics. So that the idea is that neutrality was the best way to safeguard the autonomy of the patient. It's that if we get too much in the mix, like you're describing, we somehow could be interfering with the patient becoming an autonomous subject. But I think that what ended up happening is that a lot of these concerns about neutrality and relational thinking, it was the idea that analysts were having these concerns and these sort of this wish to respond more spontaneously or expressively. So I think that the idea was it's almost it wasn't spelled out this way, but that somehow neutrality was actually at odds with the autonomy of the analyst actually. So I think it's a sort of an effort to almost to really correct what might be sort of like something that could feel a little limiting or constrictive of the analyst subjectivity.
Well, it seemed to move that from a point where limitation was kind of almost like a positive, like we were supposed to be limited, to a sense that that was restrictive, was kind of part of the relational term, was like we're being restricted too much, where before it was like the restriction was an ethical point, right? You know, to stand back was an ethical point.
Absolutely. Yeah, and along these lines, I think the papers and the work that really kind of brought this part of it out was like Lou Ahrens, the patient's experience of the analyst subjectivity, as well as Jessica Benjamin's early writing. Because the concern here is that it's not just about, hey, let's pay attention to the analyst now. Like that can be sort of portrayed as something of a caricature of relational thinking. It's the idea that if the analyst is constrained and limited, that we're actually not giving the patient the full opportunity to engage with the analyst as a full subject. So that there's something that there's actually a correspondence here. Like we, in order to sort of help the patient sort of attain full subjecthood, that we actually need to be able to achieve full subjecthood. So it's almost, I think that's a cool thing about it, is that it's not like we have to choose. It's that sort of both are necessary in order to kind of really help the patient.
And achieving full subjecthood is kind of an ongoing process. It's in a sense never achieved. We're just exactly. always going towards it. And in going towards it, the patient is transformed. Like you said, I think Edgar Levinson also had that point that we had to, if you're familiar with his work, of that you had to be transformed. In order for the patient to change as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And you have some great, maybe you can even speak about some of the case material in the book, because I think it really makes the book come alive, interspersed with the philosophical points and the theoretic points was so much great case material.
Oh, great. Yeah. Is there anything in particular that you'd like me to speak to?
Well, I'll mention there was Fred and Jonathan, but I also was thinking of the example where, I don't know, I'll bring it back to your attention when you hit a deer with your car.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that one I'm excited about, to be honest. I'm not hitting the deer. That was bad. but that one is an interesting one for me. So, yeah, basically,
sure.
do you want me to speak to it a little bit? Yeah, so, I was on my way to work, and I get to, every morning I get to work very early, and I was driving by this lovely golf course with rolling hills, and I looked off to my left, and there were just these two gorgeous deer, sort of just sitting there or just standing there in the meadow, and it's just lovely. And I'm like, this is just gorgeous. And then I hear I hit something really, really heavy. And I look back at my rear skid and I look back at my rear view mirror and I had hit a deer, and thank God that the deer was, not killed, but it was, definitely injured and sort of going up the hill. And the whole front of my car, was, destroyed basically. So I was getting to work and I was really shaken up. I was, worried for the deer, and also just like, I don't hit things every day. And I, I was a little late cause I had to like deal with my car and, the bumper hanging off and stuff like that. And I go to my 7 o'clock appointment, and I'm a few minutes late for the appointment. It was like 7:03 or something like that. And the patient is this patient who, interestingly, has been in four times weekly psychoanalysis for 15 years. And ultimately had a really bad response to it, became increasingly suicidal, was really desperate for the analyst's reassurance in various ways, but had kind of a regressive experience of the analytic process. But it went on for a very long time, and the patient's life got increasingly constrained. So I was asked to consult for the patient, and when ultimately the analyst had decided that a termination was necessary because the patient was in such a bad spot, and I could have seen him for multiple times weekly, but it seemed like there was something about that traditional structure of the analytic process that actually. That was actually not helpful for the patient. So I agreed to see him once weekly, which he was terrified by. There's a lot to that treatment. But I think what was happening is I walked down the hallway, and so the patient had made tremendous strides through working this less intensive treatment approach, still analytic, but just less intensive. And, I think I outlined more about what I actually did with him. But the point for this part of the story is that naturally, if I were late for the appointment, I would say to my patient, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm late. I just hit a deer. But with this patient, he was very, very strict in a way. He really was always afraid that everybody was going to take from him, and he felt like he needed to always get his needs met if he was going to be okay, and that the best way to do that was to try to seek this attentiveness and reassurance from the other. And I couldn't bring myself to say it. I just felt strangely kind of ashamed sitting with this. I just apologize for being late. And it gets at the way in which I think, given his sort of psychic organization, I knew that he was going to feel like he wasn't going to care about the fact that this had just happened to me. And so I couldn't make myself vulnerable to him in that way. And so ultimately, and I think this is in, I think, chapter 7 of the book, where I sort of lay out the treatment in detail, but this sort of a really important piece in terms of a part of it is when I was able to try to give voice to this and tell him about months later that what I couldn't share with him. And because I felt like he wouldn't have cared about sort of what had gone on with me that morning. And he was able to actually own, "You're right. I would have felt like you were stealing my time." And this was really what opened up the treatment, is our interest together collaboratively in his lack of responsiveness to myself as his therapist, but also to the other people in his life. And through being able to attend to this together and what this was about for him analytically, he's had pretty massive transformations in the quality of his life and his ability for intimacy and close relationships. So that, I think, is another thing, just to end on this point, that is really important to me in the book, is I feel like clinicians often have this experience of being disregarded, used, and neglected by their patients. And I think we think that we're almost, that's what's supposed to happen, because we're the clinician and they're the patient. And maybe that's true. But at the same time, countertransferentially, I don't think we often put words on those experiences. So we're almost keeping out our feeling of neglect by the patient. And in that way, we're not necessarily doing the patient any service, because if we're feeling that way, used by the patient, then most likely other people in their lives are too. And it's actually constraining their capacity for connectedness. So I think one of the things that I'm interested in the book is, how can we bring those countertransference experiences a little more explicitly into the analytic process?
And you see that kind of in an ethical dimension, that somehow it's being more more honest, more forthright, less, how is it related to to the ethical stance?
To ethics. Okay, good. That's a great question. So that actually relates to, I think, your earlier question of sort of how do I conceptualize ethics? And you know, traditionally in ethical theory, there's been this sort of longstanding debate between what's called deontology and consequentialism or utilitarianism. And essentially, it's the issue of what is the source of ethics? And consequentialists will say that it's human well-being. The issue of pleasure or flourishing is what motivates us ethically. And so we're then called upon to promote as much flourishing in the human experience as we can. Where deontology, which comes out of Kantianism, is the idea that people have certain basic rights and that they really have an intrinsic worth or a dignity that we are obligated to also respect, you know, that we like actually need to relate to other people as ends in themselves rather than just means. And so when I'm thinking about sort of motivational process through an ethical frame, I'm going to be asking the question, in what ways is the patient not motivated by my well-being? In what ways is the patient undermining my dignity? I'm also going to be asking that question of myself. In what ways am I just using the patient for a sense of self-esteem? In what ways am I not motivated by certain conscious or unconscious parts of the patient? And actually, so that's an important part of analytic listening on this approach. What am I not motivated by? You know, and also when it comes to aggression, I think actually this fits nicely with Kleinian theory. In what ways might the patient not just not be motivated by me, but actually want to harm me? And that I think is an important part that needs to be sort of looked at in the work. And so when I'm listening for the material, in addition to sort of, you know, thinking about what's motivating the patient and what's going on for them unconsciously, I'm going to be also thinking about it through this ethical lens. And usually there is some counter-transferential experience related to the ethical neglect or the ethical violation. And it could, yeah, so go ahead, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Are you saying in a way, like say, for if I just have an example, the patient doesn't show up or whatever, they're not aware of the impact on you of their not showing up in an emotional sense or that you don't exist in that moment or you're not in their mind, and that is it a goal then of the treatment to have them, you know, to use that experience so that they keep you more in mind?
Okay, great. I mean, it could be about a behavior like that, but I think often it's more about just sort of the more mundane moments of analytic process. So for example, there could be the experience of how does the patient relate to our interpretation? You know, there are times at which sort of like a patient can seem a little irritated by us interrupting them, you know, and almost wanting to sort of get back to what they're saying. And granted, that's totally fine. There's nothing sort of like inherently, quote, wrong with that. But it's just something to be noticed, right? How does the sort of patient relate to what I have to communicate? You know, it's the idea is not to basically make it all about the clinician, but it is to make sure if there's sort of calcified structures in the analytic process where the patient is disregarding or only using the therapist, can we begin to put words on this in some way? So, you know, I just did a presentation last weekend at Psychology and the Other here in Boston as this sort of conference about, you know, psychoanalysis, ethics, and theology, and sort of was giving a presentation on this very topic. And it's almost, there's a way in which, like, I have a patient, you know, for example, you know, who really values sort of the therapy. But it also feels like he just relates to me primarily as serving a function for him, whether that be providing admiration or listening or validation. And I can then feel less connected to him. You know, then we all have those patients. If you think about your caseload, you'll have the patients you feel like who really care about you as a person, and then other patients who are more just using you. And there's nothing, again, nothing wrong with that. But do we always notice that? I think we feel it, but do we put words on it?
And use it interpretively or as an intervention to?
Yes, definitely as an intervention. And like, and most likely we are countertransferentially feeling the ways that a lot of people in our patients' lives feel actually. It's usually not, sometimes it's just about us, but other times it actually gives us a big clue into what's going on for the patient at the level of the unconscious.
And I think it reminds me of Stephen Mitchell, I believe it was in Hope and Dread, that he talks about how we have conflicting goals. The patient comes in with certain ideas and wishes for treatment, but the therapist has other wishes about how the treatment's going to go. And eventually, you know, does one win out? Is it a kind of some sort of merger that goes on? But that this is often at odds for quite some time.
That's great. And I would propose this is not like, kind of like to your earlier point, this is really an issue of process over content. And I think that's something, that's why the book is called Psychoanalysis as an Ethical Process. And not like, it's not about converting our patients to be ethical. It's that there are certain experiences in sort of in us that we often don't put words on. And bringing that into the analytic discourse evolves and alters the analytic discourse. And ultimately, in some ways, it's sort of a bit of a practice of can the patient regard your independent subjectivity? And what does that actually look like? Can we begin to progressively bring it in, not to talk about it all the time, but there are times where I think, you know, the work does kind of center around patients' difficulties in this department. And ultimately it's not like any people are always doing it for their own reasons. It's usually the idea that I need to disregard you, or I need to violate you in order to get my own psychological needs met. It's not often born out of sort of just straight maliciousness. It's usually because this is what I feel like I need in order to have value and to achieve the idealized state. So we need to get to that too. But I guess my main point in the book is that traditionally we focus more on the latter, not as much on the former. And can we kind of round out the dialogue in a way?
Well, often the analyst will come up with a justification for not saying or not bringing the material you're mentioning into the room, like that the patient isn't ready to hear it, or that the timing isn't right, or I have to make sure I'm right. And so there's a kind of a rationalization to not say those things, or the patient will get so angry with me and leave or whatever, you know, this type of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, as a way of holding back. And
Yeah, you're right. It's often sort of justified in terms of the patient's needs and sort of the clinical needs. And I think there's some that's a reasonable point. But if it goes on forever, that sort of would be a concern. You know, this is definitely not about, I guess, what Freud called, quote, wild analysis, right? But yeah, definitely, you know, and so the often, but in some ways too, I think there's concerns about becoming the bad object. You know, that a lot of times we almost sort of cater to the grandiose or narcissistic wishes, and you know, sometimes self-focused wishes of the patient, because we're worried that if we don't, we're going to incur the patient's aggression. And so that is my experience, is actually being more explicit in these ways. You know, you often can get either an aggressive response or a shame response, but that becomes folded in.
Well, I think that's one of the big shifts is that's worth the risk now.
Well, the question would be that essentially, what's the loss? Is there a loss in not doing that? And I think that there is. I think, you know, the big loss is that sort of patients can remain stuck in more insular, intersubjective states, where there is meaning out there. There are other subjects out there. And I think that's sort of the importance of Jessica Benjamin's work. And also Searles would write about this when he was writing about the patient's therapeutic strivings. You know, Hoffman writes about this when he talks about patient and therapist as agents. And the idea is this is not about moralizing. This is the idea that there are other subjects who are themselves a source of meaning. And I don't know what your experience is, but for me, to be able to fully be connected to and motivated by the subjective world of another is actually like quite powerful and beautiful. And this is like, it's the reason, it's one of the, you know, the best things about my life, getting to be a therapist and a dad and a husband, you know? And sometimes I think there can be a self-indulgence that can happen, or we can inadvertently promote self-indulgence and thus more suffering by not bringing ourselves more fully into the work.
Well, I think you have to have the experience of it because it can be frightening to think that that's going to happen for all the reasons we're mentioning. But I'm glad you brought Searles into it. I think interpersonalist thinkers like Searles and Wolstein would say, if you're not saying these things, then the patient is sensing it anyway, and they're seeing in you that it's not safe to bring it up. And that
That's right.
modeling is not what you want to unconsciously or consciously invoke at all. You want to go to a place where it's worth trying this type of thing, you know, so that you get the greater intimacy and connection.
That's great. No, I think that's definitely right. Yeah, because nothing is hidden, basically, is what you're saying.
And
Yeah.
I think we've covered like kind of the therapeutic action. Is there anything else you want to say about it before we move on? Have we gotten there?
Well, the one thing about therapeutic action, which I think is important, is you know, one of the things I write about in the book is sort of the different models of therapeutic action. And I wrote about this in a paper last year as well. It came out in Dialogues. But most of our models of therapeutic action are what would be called ethically neutral. You know, they don't use ethics to explain therapeutic change. And then we have Winnicott coming along and Kohut coming along, and the contemporary self-psychologists sort of coming into the picture. And there was a big interest in the ethical capacities of the analyst, that essentially trying to kind of create an optimal holding environment, or sort of employing empathy to help restore the patient's sense of self. That's what I call ethically unilateral. You're interested in the ethics of the analyst, less about the patient. The patient is the grateful recipient of the therapist's enhanced ethical capacities. But what we have in intersubjective thinking is what I call ethical intersubjectivity, where therapeutic action is oriented towards the mutual ethical development of analyst and patient. And so that's where we have Jessica Benjamin, Searles, Hoffman, Hoffman, Slavin and Kriegman's ideas and why the analyst needs to change, and also Fonagy and Bateman's model of mentalization-based treatment, where you are trying to stimulate the patient's capacity to regard the therapist as another mind in the room. And essentially, I think I have a particular version of this ethical intersubjectivity, where we want to be asking the question of, in what ways am I consciously and unconsciously valuing the patient? And what I mean by that is, you know, I can be valuing we all have preferences of ways that we want our patients to be. You know, we may not formulate those things explicitly, but we have these preferred relational configurations between ourselves and the patient that are usually reflective of our own personalities and needs, but also the patient and who that particular patient is. So it's idiosyncratic. We don't fully spell out what that is. The patient is bringing those same forms of value into the therapeutic relationship. They are valuing us in certain ways. They're devaluing us when we do other things or relate to them in other ways. Oftentimes, this is implicit. And so my proposal in the book is that therapeutic action is oriented towards each party coming to value the other under a wider range of conditions. And that what's central there is that often the only way that this comes to happen, you know, often for the patient is that through the patient coming to know herself at a deeper level and to sort of like understand these processes within the transference. And also for us, we need to be willing to look at how am I unconsciously often using the patient for a sense of self-esteem. And oftentimes this is oriented towards our theories. You know, because if I have a theory that sort of has a particular model of health in it, then I'm going to value the patient most when they're helping me to be the good therapist. And how can we make these implicit processes a little more explicit so that we can actually, that both ourselves and the patient can come to value each other under a wider range of conditions. And that is what I would propose is actually sort of the we're becoming progressively responsive to the other person's dignity. And that's sort of the model, which you can talk more about. But I think that's the sort of my general model of change. And I realize that some listeners may say, well, that's not psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis, we're supposed to be more neutral. We're supposed to approach the process without memory or desire. But my experience is even the person who holds that view is still, we're humans. We can't not value the patient under certain conditions and devalue them under others. It's just part of being human. And so trying to kind of notice that, understand it, communicate it, and expand those conditions, I would propose is the nature of therapeutic change.
Yeah, and I suppose the challenge to it is who determines what the values are, or again, if you're involved, right? The intersubjective sense is we don't know who's where anyone begins and ends or something. I'm kind of being, you know, kind of taking the devil's advocate's point of view, and that a stance that's known as neutrality counters that you have to get out of the way, right? And you're saying, look, that's not really the case.
Yeah, and in terms of the values point, I think it's worth underscoring that is that when I use the term value, it's not like sometimes we'll use that term value as like an abstract value like justice or honesty or truth or something like that. This is more of relational valuing, right? Who do we need the other person to be? You know, do I like, you know, sort of like in just in our lives, we all have certain versions of ourselves that we like more. And then we have other versions of ourselves that we don't like at all. So usually what happens in impasses is that the patient and this is Jessica Benjamin's idea of do or done to, that the thing that you most want from me is what makes me feel bad. And the thing that I most want from you is what makes you feel bad. And so there, you're right. There's no arbiter of quote value and what's valuable, but it kind of doesn't matter. Objective value doesn't matter. It's if can we understand the ways in which we are enacting this together. And then sort of like what's ultimate, you know, it doesn't really matter as long as we can sort of start to make explicit what's really been implicit or unconscious in the dyad.
So moving on a little bit, can you speak about your ideas about technique and the role of where technique stands now in psychoanalysis?
Great. Yeah. A lot of the book, sort of like one of the sort of my big concerns in the book is that there are certain ethical experiences that I think psychoanalysis has struggled to fully explain, like the idea of altruism, like the idea of dignity. And I get into the book of sort of like where you sort of run into trouble there. And also there's been a general sort of a not full appreciation of the importance of ethics and psychoanalytic process. And it's often related to assumptions about what ethics is, you know, that somehow ethics is more about behavior, or ethics is more consciously oriented, or ethics assumes the possibility of freedom, or in psychoanalysis, we need to also appreciate the ways in which we're determined. So all these assumptions. So what I try to do in the book is to advocate a dialectical model of ethics, where we try to hold these dialectics, the dialectic between consciousness and unconscious, the dialectic between self and other. I think that's another thing that has prevented psychoanalysts from sort of fully embracing some of these ethical ideas, is that there's the idea that ethics is too focused on the needs of others, and what about the self? So a lot of these sort of, if we embrace more of a dialectical vision of ethics, we can hold a lot of these polarities. Now, that is important implications for technique, because my proposal is that that a lot of these dialectics, if we're going to have a you know, what I call an ethical psychoanalysis, we're going to need to hold these dialectics. And that means, from a technical perspective, attending to aspects of the patient's consciousness as well as unconscious. You know, attending not just to their motivational processes, but to their actual behaviors. How do they live in the world? You know, it's and also attending not just to the patient's experience, but to other subjects' experience, whether it be the other people in the patient's life, whether it be us as the other person in the patient's life. And also, I think another important dialectic is this dialectic between exploration and change. You know, I think historically, a lot of analytic thinking has been oriented towards the idea that change comes as a byproduct of the exploratory process. Which I totally believe, but there's also a way in which we can't fully evade our responsibility that there are maybe other things our patients need other than exploration, and sort of how do we balance that? So a lot of what I'm trying to propose in the book is holding these dialectics technically, so that we're attending to these multiple dimensions of the patient's life rather than just focusing on essentially exploration, self, unconscious process. And I think in practice, actually, this is what analysts do. But for some reason, our theories don't fully embrace these ideas. So I think there's a gap between what we actually do in practice, which is necessary in order to be connected to the patient as a real person, as a full person, and then how we write about it. And how we write about what's done from the perspective of technique. So that's my broad, I don't know if that's what you're asking, but that's sort of my broad stance on trying to take a more dialectical approach to technique in the analytic process.
Well, you bring up a point towards the end of the book about really being concerned about what helps the patient. And I think that maybe based on our personalities, all of us, some of us, we stick with our theory, maybe in contrast to helping to what actually would be of service to the patient in a kind of pragmatic way, because that's not analytic or whatever. So our theory becomes kind of a fallback and so seductive. It's such a kind of something we can really hold on to. It's also very gratifying to have complex theory.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where theory, I think, can become dangerous, because the theory, actually, I don't write about this in the book, but this is one thing I think about, which is there's another dialectic that we have to maintain, which is the dialectic between theory and life, you know, or treatment and life, that we need to actually be accountable to patients' actual lives, which I think, you know, oftentimes we are, but there are times where the justification to what you're getting at for sort of not attending to the patient's functioning is that it's not analytic, and that, well, what I'm doing here is more of an analytic treatment. And, you know, I think there can be ethical challenges with that, especially when, and I think like the case that I write about in the book, Jonathan, where they're having a countertherapeutic response. So I totally agree.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity. There's so much more to talk about. The book is just very rich and has a lot of surprises and, you know, just great things in it. But maybe you have a second to tell us what you're working on now.
So it relates to what I mentioned earlier in the you know, the discussion, which is I just sort of put forward a panel proposal for the IARP conference in Los Angeles. So we'll see if it gets accepted. But I just finished my next paper, which is called the patient as an ethical subject, technical implications of the patient's irreducible responsibility. So that's a play on Rennick's important article about the irreducible subjectivity of the analyst. An implication of the ethical turn in psychoanalysis is that patients also have an ethical responsibility, whether it be to other people in their lives or to the analyst herself. And I realize this may be controversial. Actually, I think maybe that's why I'm sort of interested in it. But really what I'm sort of talking about is that it's an interesting thing where we call it, like, if you look at our models of therapeutic action, they really do emphasize this mutual ethical development of analyst and patient, many of these theories that I mentioned earlier in the discussion. But for some reason, we don't think about that as much at the level of technique. You know, so we have a model of health where the patient is ethically constituted, but how often do we talk about essentially like how patients develop ethically and how does that relate to their therapeutic progress? We tend to kind of almost think like, well, the analyst assumes responsibility for their role in the impasse, and then we explore, and then naturally this development happens. But there is a way in which we could actually be avoiding our responsibility along these lines as well. So part of what I try to get to is actually giving ideas about what a theory of technique that would do this would sort of be oriented around, that still privileges exploration of the unconscious while also affirming the patient as an ethical subject.
Great. Look forward to seeing it, and maybe seeing you in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we'll see.
I just wanted to thank you for being on today. We've been speaking with Robert Drozek, who's the author of Psychoanalysis as an Ethical Process, which is on Routledge. This is Christopher Bandini for New Books in Psychoanalysis and the New Books Network.